Thank you for listening to this podcast from TRE, Talk Radio Europe, your voice in Spain and around the world. For more information, please visit tre.radio.
The TRE Book Show is sponsored by Audible. Click on the Audible banner on the talkradioeurope.com homepage to download your free audiobook today. Terms and conditions apply.
The Book Programme. Presented by Hannah Murray.
Good evening. Welcome to tonight's book show. My first guest, Eve Bonham, studied at university in Ireland and worked as an English teacher in Southeast Asia. For 14 years, she lived in a village in France and now lives in Dorset. Her latest novel, Dear Magpies, is her fourth novel and is a heartwarming tale of tragic secrets, separation, bereavement, and hope. It follows Josie Cuff trying to trace her estranged grandchildren. Also with us is Amy Heidenreich, who's a writer and book blogger based in South Africa. Her novel, The Pact, is about a seemingly harmless prank on a work colleague that goes horribly wrong. Also joining us is Talia Hibbert, who lives in a bedroom full of books. She writes sexy, diverse romance because she believes that people of marginalised identities need honest and positive representatives. Her latest novel, Get a Life, Chloe Brown, is about a chronically ill computer geek with a goal, a plan, and a list to help her get a life. And finally, on tonight's book show is Leslie Sefton, whose memoir Addict Child charts the journey she was forced to take alongside her alcoholic, drug-abusing daughter. She's with us on the book show, though, to talk about her novel Apportion Blame. It's a psychological thriller where three neighbours are involved in the accidental death of a child. Who is to blame and who will pay the price? That's all on tonight's book show on Talk Radio Europe.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Open up the dirty window, let the sun illuminate the words that you could not find. Reaching for something in the distance, so close you can almost taste it. Release your inhibitions, feel the rain on your skin. No one else can feel it for you, only you can let it in. No one else, no one else can speak the words on your lips. Drink yourself in words unspoken, live your life.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now from the UK is Eve Bonham, who studied at university in Ireland and worked as an English teacher in Southeast Asia. For 14 years, she lived with her family in a village in France and now lives in Dorset. She's the author of various books, including Madness, Lies and Other Stories and To the End of the Day. She was with us a few years ago now on the book show talking about the lost journey homeward. She's back with us on the book show to talk about her fourth novel. It's called Dear Magpies. And it's a heartwarming tale of tragic secrets, separation, bereavement and hope. Welcome to the book show, Eve.
Thank you very much, Hannah.
It's a pleasure to have you back with us. And
I'm delighted to be here again.
You've been very busy, haven't you?
I have, yes. I'm always busy.
And you've been doing lots of sailing, I understand.
Well, I've done lots of sailing all my life. I don't do so much now. But this book that I've just written and it's just been published called Dear Magpies is the only book that I've actually really touched on my sailing experiences. It's something that obviously has been very important in my life, and therefore it's nice to write about it for a change.
Was it fun to kind of reminisce then, remembering all the time sailing and bringing it into a book?
Yes, it was. It was. Although in the book, this is about a particular. Actually, it is a real hurricane that actually happened, and it is about something that happens in the book in a storm, and that's never very pleasant at sea. And
no.
I've been through a few.
Oh, really? Gosh, how awful! Must be frightening.
Yes, it is. I haven't been through a hurricane, but I've been through a severe storm, and that is very frightening. Yes.
So, tell us about the characters in Dear Magpies.
Well, Dear Magpies is a story of a woman. I chose a slightly older woman because a lot of books tend to feature very young people and people in their 20s and 30s, and I thought a woman with about 60 would have a lot to talk about. She's called Josie, and she's living in a rented cottage in Dorset, and she's been trying for 10 years to find her grandchildren. Now, they used to live in Australia, and her son has died, and her daughter-in-law, for whatever reason is not apparent initially, has decided to remove the grandchildren and obviously take them off somewhere, maybe to another country. And she is desperate because it's been 10 years now, and she hasn't heard anything from them. She doesn't even know whether they're alive. And if they are, she's not even sure they would remember her. So she's quite distressed, but she's getting on with her life, and she's still searching for them. But what she's doing is, as a kind of way to connect with her grandchildren, she's writing them letters, even though she knows she can't post them or email them, to kind of sort of have a connection with them in her head. So a lot of the book is made out of emails, actually, which she's sending to her now teenage grandchildren.
Oh, what an amazing idea. Do you know where it came from, the idea for this story?
Well, I've actually been interested in parents being estranged from children, because I read an article about 5 years ago in The Guardian about how very distressing and painful it is when parents get separated from their children, and perhaps one parent takes them off and goes abroad, and the other person is desperate because they can't contact them. And also, the same happens with grandparents sometimes, because grandparents also get estranged from their grandchildren sometimes because the parents won't allow them access. And the really sad thing is that actually there is no legal right of access. I discovered this because I got onto a charity called Grandparents Plus, which is about grandparents who have various different problems, and they say that losing contact with a grandchild is very painful, and the sad thing is that there's no automatic right of contact. And I thought this was interesting, and I thought it swirled around in my head for a while, and then, as it happens, my son and his family, my three grandchildren who are aged 4, 2, and 3 months, work in a fairly inaccessible country in sub-Saharan Africa. And so I only see them once a year. And so I have had first-hand experience of missing my grandchildren, not knowing where they were, but just not having them. And I think it happens a lot with people who have children overseas, and I feel it's something that needs to be aired. And so I thought I would write a story based on that.
Yes, absolutely. That's an interesting point, and really, really sad, and I guess quite shocking that grandparents don't have any legal rights in that respect to see their grandchildren.
It is sad, especially as all the courts always say that grandparents have a really important role to play in their grandchildren's lives, but there isn't actually an enforceable law that says that they have a right to see them, which is sad. But in my book, Dear Magpies, the children are as it were, on the other side of the world, and they disappeared, and she's desperate because she just can't track them down. And so she's tried everything, and now she's pretty much at the end of her, the end of the line, and she thinks, well, I'll just keep writing to them in the hope that one day I'll be able to send these things to them, and that's what she does. And meanwhile, she's had a pretty turbulent life in South America, and she's done a vast amount of things. So she's now moved to a Dorset village. It's the first time that I've based a book in Dorset, and I live in Dorset. So it's rather fun this time to actually to create an imaginary Dorset village. And Josie lives in this village, and she tells her grandchildren in a sort of quite entertaining way about the sort of her life in the village and the various enigmatic and eccentric characters who inhabit it. And so the book is talking about her past and about her present.
lovely setting as well at Dorset Village. It must have been interesting to kind of make one up as well.
Yes, I had a bit of fun with that because I thought, what am I going to call it? There are actually 15 or 16 Winterbournes in Dorset.
Yes.
And they've all got nice quirky little characteristics and things and stories about them. And there's a village called Sleep as well, S-L-E-P-E. So I called my village Winterbourne Sleep, which doesn't exist, but just as it amuses me, I took a few little stray stories or quirky things about the various different winter balls, and I planted them in my village. So if people read them, they'll think, oh, that's my village. And then somebody else will think, oh, that's my village. And it could be because I've just planted these little tiny things, seeds, if you like, into the story just for a bit of fun. But no, the village is not based on my village at all. And the characters are not based on people I know, except that I draw quite a lot of character traits from friends and sort of plant them in different characters and hope that they're not too identifiable.
Yes, artistic license.
Yes, absolutely. After all, what do you have to write about what you know about. I mean, places you've been to, people you've met, books you've read, all that stuff. So that's how you write. You write from your own experience. So you're bound to bring in people you've met, and you just hope that you can disguise them well enough if they're quirky and different.
Absolutely. So how does sailing come into the book?
Well, sailing is something that Josie's first husband does in South America. He's a very keen sailor, and he does take her along, but when her son comes along as a child, he tends to leave her behind. And the I don't want to spoil the story, but he goes off on a sailing voyage with a friend, and they encounter this terrible severe storm, and so that's quite interesting. I think I'll leave it at that.
Yes, fair enough. And what about the character of Josie? Can you tell us more about her?
Well, she's completely disorganised and sort of unlucky, really. She's had a rough deal in life. You know, she's had bereavements and she's lost her only child, her son. And but she's a likable character. She's courageous and, you know, got initiative and a sense of humour. But she has worries in addition to them to not being able to contact her lovely grandchildren. And you know, she's got worries of financial worries. She's, you know, hadn't got any money. She's threatened with eviction and unemployment, and she's sort of living on sort of, you know, slightly on a slender, very very slender income, and everything is a little bit, she's a bit vulnerable. So the other thing that is important in the story is that there's clearly somebody in the village watching her, and in fact he starts to intrude in her home and her house. And the reader doesn't know why, but it gradually becomes apparent that this is something to do with something that has happened in her life in South America. And it's throughout the story, the reader is puzzling about who this person might be, because he's kind of threatening. And she, being so terribly chaotic and disorganized, doesn't realize that actually there is, and then gradually she becomes convinced that somebody is in her home, and very unsettling.
And what about the expression magpies? That's what she calls her grandchildren. Where did you get that from?
Well, magpies are obviously a real, really symbolic bird. But the reason she calls them that is because when they were little children, they used to have a lot of baths, and the children's father, her son Julian, bought them some black and white towels, and they wrapped them up, and she said, oh, they look like magpies, and Julian said, oh, that's what I shall call them, magpies. So it's a little childhood nickname. But also magpies are incredibly symbolic, and they have, you know, a reputation for being, if you see one, it's sort of sorrow or bad luck or trickery. And if you have two, it's, you know, happiness and good fortune. And so there's a lot of folklore surrounds magpies. In fact, I'll recite this because it's quite fun. There's a nursery rhyme, you know, one for sorrow, that one. And the Irish version goes like this. One for sorrow, two for joy. Three for a girl, four for a boy, five for silver, six for gold, seven for a secret never told, eight for a letter from over the sea, and nine for a love as true as can be. And I thought to myself, well, all of those elements are in my story.
Yes, very
clever. Every one of them. because her letters are from over the sea, and there's lots of secrets, and there's a true love, and boys and girls. The cover of the book, which obviously we're on radio, so you can't see it, but it's against a blue background, very plain, and there's a silhouette of a teenage boy and a teenage girl, but only in silhouette because Josie doesn't know them very well. And then flying off out of them, as it were, out of the picture into the sort of blue, pale blue yonder, are two magpies. And they've, if you like, stolen her peace of mind.
Yes, it's very beautiful, actually, the cover. It's really well done.
Yeah, people really like it. I've had a lot of feedback about it.
Yes. So how did this book and the writing of this book and the subject matter and everything differ from the other books that you've written?
Well, the other book was... Actually, all the books are about hope, if you like, and about sort of getting through adversity, but I expect that you could say that about a lot of books, actually. The last book was the Lost Journey Homeward, was a retelling of the story of the prodigal son. And in fact, she's a prodigal daughter in my book, and she comes back home and sort of creates mayhem where her brother, who is the sort of disapproving elder brother, is trying to run a hotel. So that's very much a love story, but it's also a story about a journey, if you like, because the elder brother has to take a journey to learn how to see a bit of life and understand that, you know, he's pretty judgmental. And and then he also experiences the sort of temptations that his sister had, and then he starts to be a bit more human. If you like, it's very different, really. This story is very much about a person in a particular place. It has a strong sense of place in Dorset, and whereas the other book sort of ranged all over the place. So it is quite different, really.
Yes. Well, it's lovely to chat with you again, Eve Bonham. If people want to get a copy of Dear Magpies, it's available now on our website in the TRE bookshop section on tre.radio. It's been lovely chatting with you, Eve. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much, Hannah.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now is Amy Heidenreich, who's a writer and book blogger based in South Africa. When she's not writing her own fiction, she ghostwrites books and columns for global tech and financial companies. But she's with us on the book show to talk about her latest novel. It's called The Pact, and it asks the question, could a harmless prank lead to murder? Welcome to the book show, Amy.
Thank you so much. I'm happy to be here.
Oh, it's great to have you with us. And how long have you been writing for now? It seems like you've been doing it a while.
I've been writing for about 10 years now. I started with short fiction around 2010, but then I moved into writing my own novels around 2013 or so. And The Pact is my second published novel.
Fantastic. And is it very different writing the full-length novels compared to the short stories?
It is. The short story is more an intense burst of a certain mood or a feeling. And a book, you've got to draw that out a lot more. But a full-length novel is amazing because you can really explore all aspects of the story. But both definitely have to have a strong narrative that keeps the reader engaged the whole way through.
Yeah. Does it take more planning to do a novel, do you think?
More planning?
Yeah.
I think it does. So for my first novel, I actually wrote it quite intuitively without much planning at all. But The Pact, certainly, I plotted it very carefully. So because there were so many clues and twists throughout the novel, that has to be controlled and rolled out, you know, in quite a specific way. And yeah, short fiction, you definitely don't have to worry too much about that.
And where did you get the sort of idea from for The Pact, do you think? Did it come from somewhere particular?
So it was originally an idea of my own experience in the workplace when I first started out as a journalist. There was a bit of office bullying in my newsroom, and because we were all quite young, not everyone dealt with it in the best way. And that's where, for me, all my ideas for thrillers are rooted in pushing an average situation to its most extreme level. So then I got thinking, what would happen if either office bullying got pushed to fever pitch.
Do you think there's quite a lot of office bullying that happens?
Absolutely. It was quite interesting. When I was doing my research for the pact, I put a call on social media for any stories of people that had experienced bullying in the office. I wanted to understand how they reacted to it emotionally and even physically. And my inbox got flooded within an hour or so. And it was stories from powerful women, people that I thought, you know, would never, who were very strong, who I thought would never suffer from those sorts of feelings and being victimized in that way. But it's so prevalent and it really affects people quite deeply. I think it's almost a bit of an unspoken taboo at the moment, how much it occurs and how it really damages people.
Yeah, it's a strange thing, isn't it? Because you kind of expect, well, I say expect, it shouldn't happen at all. But, you know, the fact that bullying goes on with children and at school, we hear a lot about it and trying
yes,
to, you know, do something about it. But I think people think less of bullying as something that adults would do to each other. It's quite a strong word to use, isn't it? And I think a lot of people would never admit or like to think of themselves as being a bully.
Oh, completely. I think there's a lot of shame involved as well. So when someone's victimized in that way, they start blaming themselves or trying to try and make sense of why they've been targeted. And I think especially in a workplace where it's so rooted in achievement and your performance, I think people immediately think, oh, I should be doing something more. And you certainly see that in the character of Freya in the pact, where she's a very high-achieving person. So she immediately takes on the bullying as something that's her fault. And I think that's why people take so long to speak up about it. And also in the current, you know, global economic climate where jobs are not abandoned, I think when people get a good job in their field and something that's working well for them, they want to do as much as they can to keep it. And that often means putting up with circumstances that aren't ideal.
Yeah. And can you tell us a bit more about Freya, one of the main characters in the book?
So Freya is she's just graduated from a IT tech degree at university. She's an amazing developer, and she gets taken on by a startup in San Francisco. And she is extremely driven. She's quite a genius at what she does. She naturally just is very smart. Work is everything to her. It's very central that she achieves and does well and builds a new life for herself, because she comes from a bit of a underprivileged background. And so she enters the workplace with very high hopes, and it's a place that she always dreamed of being in. She can't believe her luck, but then her circumstances take a turn for the worse when she is targeted by an office bully.
Yes, that's Nicole, isn't it?
Yeah, that's Nicole. So Nicole is the ex-girlfriend of one of the executives at the company called Jay, and Jay takes a romantic interest in Freya. So there's a bit of jealousy in Nicole's behavior. Nicole is also a very powerful, intelligent woman in her own right. And the reason that she's targeting her becomes clearer as the book goes on.
Jealousy is such an awful thing, isn't it? When, you know, when you've got women like that in business, both successful, they should be supporting and encouraging each other, shouldn't they?
Oh, completely. And I think that was a theme I really wanted to explore, because in the Me Too era, we are all becoming a lot more comfortable with speaking of the relationships between men and women in the workplace and how they fall short. And with modern feminism, we also assume that we are all fighting for the same cause, we're all women standing for the same thing. But unfortunately, some women do try and bring each other down. And I do believe that by through reading it and talking about it, we can make it less taboo and hopefully lessen it a bit.
Yeah, absolutely. So can you tell us a little bit more about what happens in the pact without giving too much away?
Of course. So as I mentioned earlier, Freya is in this dream job and she is bullied by Nicole for reasons that she's not quite sure about, because the bullying is quite vicious and it escalates quite quickly. But it pushes Freya to breaking points. And the one night they have an office party, they have a bit to drink, and Freya and Jay play a prank on Nicole. And it's a silly thing that they post online. They end up, with what they post, they end up sharing Nicole's residential address. And it's honestly, it's something that absolutely anybody could do. And it's harmless. They think that the next day, you know, they're just going to have a hangover and forget about it. But then the next day, Nicole is found dead in her apartment. And not only that, Freya receives a message on her phone indicating that somebody knows about the prank that she pulled and that she might be next.
Wow, great story. Spooky.
Completely. I don't know why I write these things. I scare myself sometimes because they could honestly happen in real life.
Wow. So do you think you'll stick with this genre? Do you think you'll write others in this particular field?
Yeah, I love thriller writing because I think that it's something that I know a person can take with them on holiday or to the beach, and they can really engage with it and be lost and have a form of escape. But at the same time, you can speak about social issues in a safe space. So, and yeah, I think it's a way to engage with our world in a way that's still fun and gripping.
Yeah, makes perfect sense. Well, it's been great to chat with you, Amy Heindriff. If people want to get a copy of the book, it's called The Pact, and people can get it from our website, tre.radio, in the bookshop section. Amy, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now from the UK is Talia Hibbert, who lives in a bedroom full of books. She writes sexy, diverse romance because she believes that people of marginalised identities need honest and positive representation. She's with us on the book show to talk about her latest book. It's called Get a Life, Chloe Brown. Chloe is a chronically ill computer geek with a goal, a plan, and a list. Welcome to the book show, Talia.
Hi, thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure. Thanks very much for joining us. And I love the idea that you live in a bedroom full of books.
Seems the best way to describe it. I'm in my room now and looking around, all I can see is books. So.
Oh, how lovely. Have you always been like that?
I have, yeah. Ever since I can remember, some of my earliest memories of being told off by my mother are because I left so many books lying around. And she was like, someone's going to fall and break their neck. We need more bookshelves in here.
So always being an avid reader then, when did you decide or start to become a writer?
I think that I always dreamed of being a writer. You know, when you love books so much, it's very easy to make the leap into, well, I want to create one of these things. But it took me quite a while to kind of build the confidence and also the skill to actually write and finish a story.
And did you always know the kind of books that you wanted to write and the sort of subject matters you wanted to cover?
Not completely. I had some idea about kind of the tropes and story arcs that really spoke to me. But in terms of genre and realizing that I wanted to write romance novels, that took me a little while because I really enjoy things like fantasy and science fiction. And so starting out, I thought, well, I'm going to write a fantasy novel. I'm going to write this or that. But it never quite worked out for me because I let the rest of the plot fall by the wayside so that I could focus on the romantic relationship at the center of the story. And it took me a little bit to think, well, maybe I should just write books that focus on the romantic relationship, and then it won't be a failure, it'll be a success.
Yeah, absolutely. Well done, you. So tell us a bit more about the character of Chloe Brown. She sounds great.
I'm actually really happy with how people have responded to Chloe, because she's not the typical heroine or even the typical hero. She's very grouchy. She's very sarcastic. She can best be described as an uptight grump with very few social skills. But I think that she's great fun, and happily a lot of people have kind of seen the humor in her as well. So I'm really glad about that.
Yeah. So she, in the book, decides to write a sort of get a life list type thing. Tell us about this list.
Exactly. So Chloe is chronically ill. She has fibromyalgia and she lives with chronic pain. And because she likes to control things and because she just likes to look after herself and she worries about making things worse, she realizes that she's kind of let her world become very small. And so she makes a commitment to have adventures and to experience new things and to basically get a life. So she writes this list of things that she feels she should be doing to kind of unlock this cool, exciting version of herself. But it doesn't quite work out like that.
Yes, best laid plans and all of that. So tell us about some of the things that are on her list, can you?
Yeah, well, one of the things that she starts out with is moving out of her family home because she still lives with her parents. And I think that quite a few chronically ill or disabled people can relate to that, because it's nice to have people to help out on those days when you can't really do anything. But at the same time, you can struggle with ideas about independence. So the first thing she does is move out on her own, and she kind of has to figure out a new routine and a new way of caring for herself alone. And then there are other more fun things, like she wants to ride a motorbike, which she's never done. And that is kind of how she falls into cahoots with the hero, because they don't really get on, but he has a motorbike. And she's like, well, if you take me out for a ride, I'll do something for you. And then I'll be one step further on in my list.
And she also wants to enjoy a drunken night out. Has she not done that before then?
No, she hasn't, because she got ill around the time she was at university, and also because she's just not really that kind of person. Another reason why she makes this list is because, aside from being chronically ill, she's just quite a quiet person who prefers to stay at home. And I think that sometimes introverted people can start to feel like, oh, am I a bit boring? Which isn't the case, but I feel like people can think that about themselves. So she gets this idea that she needs to do quote unquote fun things, like going out and getting drunk. But again, that doesn't quite work out.
And she also has something on there to do something bad. I'm intrigued as to what this something bad could be. I suppose that's giving it away, is it?
Maybe. You do find out what the something bad is quite early on in the book, though. So I won't give it away, but it's there.
Okay, brilliant. And I bet it was great fun coming up with this list and putting the story together, was it?
It really was. I really had to get into her mindset and kind of think, what would Chloe think is really outrageous that she needs to give a go? So that was a lot of fun.
And did you have anyone in mind in your own life sort of relating to the character of Chloe?
I think most of all, I relate to the character of Chloe more than anyone I know. We're definitely not exactly the same, but I have fibromyalgia myself, so a lot of my experiences inspired Chloe's character in that way. And also, you know, with me living in a bedroom full of books and everything, I'm not really the partying type either. So maybe I could do with a get a life list as well.
Oh, why not? Is it, do you think you could? Has it inspired you to think maybe if it worked for Chloe, it could work for me?
I feel like I should think that, and I should take this as a moment of inspiration to like broaden my horizons. But actually, I really don't want to. I just want to sit at home and read. So.
Fair enough. As long as you're happy, that's the most important thing. So do you think there could be more stories involving Chloe, or is it definitely a one-off book?
I am actually in the process of writing stories about her sisters. She has two sisters. So there's book 2 about her younger sister, and then book 3 about their younger sister, and Chloe is going to pop up in those stories, which is a lot of fun. But I don't think that Chloe's going to have another book of her own. She's more going to be making cameos in her family members' stories.
Oh, that's a nice idea, though. When did you decide to do that?
Well, actually, reading a lot of romance, I feel like that's quite a common thing in romance where you focus on one couple and then you might move on, but you still get to see how your old favourites are doing. And I really love that. So I definitely wanted to incorporate that in my series.
Yeah, it's a great, great idea. And how much time do you spend kind of working on the characters as opposed to the plot? You know, how do you construct the book? Do you just write, or is there a lot of planning that goes into it?
It definitely varies from book to book. Some books and some characters I kind of build in my head over time without even trying, so that when I sit down and write, it just comes out. But then there are other books where I get this vague idea, but I really have to sit and plan to work out how to execute it best. I think that whichever method I take, I definitely focus on building the characters the most, because for me, the characters really drive the plot. For example, in Get a Life, Chloe Brown, the whole plot of completing her list wouldn't exist if it weren't for the person that Chloe is in the first place. So I'd say that when I do plan my books, most of that time is spent on character, whereas the plot kind of comes more as I'm writing.
That makes sense. Well, if people want to get a copy of the book, it's called Get a Life, Chloe Brown, and it's available to buy on our website in the TRE bookshop section. It's by Talia Hibbert, who we've been chatting to today. Talia, thanks so much for joining us, and best of luck with the book.
Thank you so much. I've had a great time.
And your list as well. Good luck with your own list if you decide to do it.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
Joining us on the line now from the UK is Leslie Sefton to talk about her latest novel, Apportion Blame. It's a psychological thriller where three neighbours are involved in the accidental death of a child. Welcome to the book show, Leslie.
Thank you, Hannah.
Pleasure. Thanks very much for joining us. So am I right in saying this is your first novel?
It's my first novel, but my second published work. I have published a memoir.
Yes, the memoir, very different to the yes. novel. Was the whole writing process very different as well?
Yes, kind of, because when you're writing a memoir, you're pouring more of yourself into it, whereas a novel, it's a lot easier to get and change things and rearrange things. But the actual writing process is the same, I would say.
Because your memoir was about your daughter, wasn't it? It was very yes. personal.
Yes, she was an addict, alcohol and drugs. She's now 6 years in recovery, thankfully.
Oh, fantastic. And was it a bit cathartic writing the book?
For her, very much so, yes. And for me, in the actual writing process, it got a lot out of me. But what happened with her is I did a blog to start with, and I blogged daily on her journey and mine alongside her. And it brought a lot of people back into her life. And she read through reading the blog and people contacting her. She realised that, you know, she was loved and people cared about her. And I think that helped her a lot to pull away from the lifestyle she was living.
Oh, that's fantastic. What an amazing outcome. Wonderful.
Yes.
So when and why did you decide you wanted to write a novel?
I've been playing about with the idea for years. I mean, I've been working on the novel came before doing the memoir, actually.
Okay.
And then I put it to one side to concentrate on that. And then when that was done and marketed and all the rest of it, I decided to pick up the novel again and carry on with that.
And where did the general idea come from for this story, do you know?
Well, a boy stepped out in front of me. Unfortunately, he had Asperger's syndrome. And I would say he was about 14, and it was the first day his mother had let him out on his own. And I was driving down the lane, and he just walked out from behind the bus and hit my car. Luckily, we were only doing about 20 miles an hour, because I'd stopped to wait to see if, you know, another car would come round the bus. And I comforted him, and he was fine, and ambulance came, all the rest of it. And then the police were involved, and they breathalysed me and took a statement. And kind of that's where my idea came from. Do you know how easy it is to just be minding your own business, no fault of your own, and you're involved in an accident?
Gosh, that must have been just awful for you. A horrible thing to happen.
It was, but things happen, and his mum was wrote me a letter, which was lovely, because I'd taken good care of him, and that's how I knew about his background, because she told me.
Yeah. Oh, wow. So tell us a bit about the story of apportion blame then.
Okay. So after consuming alcohol and drugs, a law student who is with an acquaintance in a car is the only witness to this accident. So the two of them only know about the accident. He backs off, the law student backs a car off a cobble lane by the side of his mother's house and knocks down a young girl who lives opposite. She had sneaked out to buy sweets. After knocking the girl over, Richard, the law student, drives the car back onto the cobbles. He and PJ, the witness, run back into the house, not knowing if the child is alive or dead. So essentially, they just left her in the road because they're more concerned about how it affects them, because they know they've been doing drugs and alcohol.
Mm.
So the child now lies in the road on this rainy evening. They run upstairs in the house they've gone back in, and actually, looking out from the upstairs bedroom window, the child lay on the road. Richard, that's the law student, finally formulates a plan to help her, but more importantly, to help himself. So he decides to go outside as if he's just come out of the house and seen her there lying in the road. He tells PJ to follow him. PJ is transfixed on looking out of the window, and he does not follow Richard. He focuses his vision through the torrential rain, waiting to see Richard reach out to the girl. As Richard approaches the lane from the side of the house, PJ sees another car hurtling down the lane. The driver of this car runs over the same child.
Oh, no. My goodness, how awful.
Yes.
Wow. So you obviously had the idea for the story inspired by the situation that happened with you. How did you formulate the characters?
If you're a writer, you'll understand this. You can just write and they come in your mind and then you put them down on paper. It's quite a fascinating process, really.
Mm. So did you plan a lot before, or you just wrote then and it came out?
I just write and write. And then what I do is, like, I'll write bits, you know, like about a character or about a situation or a scene, and then like a jigsaw puzzle, I'll piece them all together and rearrange. It's not like I start at the beginning and write the whole book as one. There's a lot of chopping and changing going on. I would say the majority of writing is about editing.
Yeah, absolutely. So what more can you tell us about these two gentlemen, the law student and PJ?
Okay, so the law student's got a wealthy father, although he lives with his mother, but he stays at university as well. He's in his third year of a law degree, and he's very self-assured, very quite arrogant and entitled because he's spoiled. His consideration is to look after himself, you know, and make sure everything in his life's fine. He doesn't have a lot of regard for other people. Then you've got PJ, who's a shy character. He's a car mechanic, and he's got a passion for gaming. So, in a way, he's quite a nerdy guy. He's good at his job, he's a car mechanic, but his passion, as I said, is doing the gaming, and that's what really takes up his time.
Okay. And what about Claire?
Claire, she's infatuated with Richard because they all live round and about near each other. She's an on-off girlfriend of Richard's.
Okay. Okay. And how old is the child that gets run over?
She's 7.
Oh, and do we know much about her? Does she feature in the story?
She did originally, and then I cut quite a bit of that out because it was getting too protracted. Mm. We know about her through her parents. Her parents gave birth to her late in life. They couldn't conceive at first. And he was a teacher, a dad is a teacher, and a mum is a radiographer, and it is their only child that they've lost. And the mother, when she gave birth to the child, suffered from postnatal depression. So, you know, there's a bit in the book that goes and describes all the background of having postnatal depression and what that meant to this mother and how it affects her again when the child dies.
Yeah. Wow. So have you decided to write more books in the sort of psychological thriller genre? Do you think that fits well with you?
Yes, I like kind of the dark side of life, but it's not all doom and gloom. There's a lot of intimate details in the story to highlight how the characters behave and interact with one another. So, you know, there is ups and downs with this book.
Mm.
But at the moment, I'm working on short stories and poetry, so I'll probably do a collection with those.
Wow, fantastic. So from a memoir to a psychological thriller to short stories and poems, you're doing everything.
Yes.
Good for you.
My hobby.
Yeah, fantastic. Well, if people want to get a copy of A Portion Blame, it's by Leslie Sefton, who we've been chatting to today, and it's available to buy on our website and tre.radio. Leslie, thanks very much for joining us.
Yes, thank you, Hannah. It was a pleasure.
The Book Programme, presented by Hannah Murray.
You've been listening to a TRE production. If you've enjoyed this program, there'll be another episode waiting for you next week, right here on this platform, where you can also access our extensive back catalogue of shows and interviews. For more information on our live programming, social media channels, and apps, and how to contact Talk Radio Europe, please visit tre.radio.